As I mentioned, it's Palm Sunday today, but we're continuing in our series in James, and I think it's kind of neat how that some of the Palm Sunday theme is intertwined with what we're going to talk about this morning from our series in James. If you didn't get an outline this morning, I think they were inserted in the bulletins, but if you did not get an outline this morning, raise your hand. These good-looking men will make sure you have one. That way you can color or doodle or whatever you do to keep your mind going. James 5:7 begins with the word therefore. In the NIV, I read, be patient then. Whether you use the word then or therefore, we must know that obviously there's something that's happened before this that the verses that follow refer back to. So as you're looking at the book, the question is James going back to what I've continued to go back to the last several weeks? Is he still going back to that phrase in James 4:6 where he says, but he gives more grace? And we saw there that our depravity was the theme just before that. And then he gives more grace, therefore you can do all these things. And we've been looking at all these imperatives. Or when he says, therefore, in 5:7, knowing that he's towards the end of what he's going to say, he's running out of steam a little bit here, that maybe James is looking back towards the whole book. And I'm not sure exactly what James is thinking, but if he is looking at the whole book, over in chapter 1, there we said that James was counseling us concerning our relationship with God. I want to read to you James 1:18. James 1:18, I read, of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth. You can't say that James believed in anything but redemption, salvation as being a work of God. He says, of his own will he brought us forth. He borned us, he begat us by the word of truth. God is the one who saves, and he uses his word to do so. And yet throughout this book, James has talked about doing stuff. And so our theme, it's a faith that works. And even this particular verse, James 1:18, of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. And at the end of that chapter, James 1, I hope you have your Bibles open to the book of James. We're going to be going back and forth a little bit here in James, but I won't make you turn someplace else today, just James. James 1:26, but if anyone among you thinks he is religious, you think you got this salvation thing and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their afflict trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. So if he's thinking, as he says, therefore, here at the conclusion of the book, if he's making us think back, we have to think back on the fact that we got to have the right thought about God, and that salvation is from God, but accompanying that salvation, that grace from God, is a faith that of necessity is going to work. And as we get into chapter 2, we saw that that faith that works impacts our relationship with other peoples. He starts in chapter 2 by talking about being prejudiced, and then he talks about the fact that you can see someone's faith. I think as you look at James and trying to think back a little bit on the whole series this week, I think there's two areas particularly that James seems to hammer. One is our tongue. You can't miss that in the book. James chapter 3, he says, James 3 verse 2, for we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he's a perfect man, and able to bridle his own body. And then chapter 4, verse 11 and 12, where we were a few weeks ago, do not speak evil of one another, brother. And then he says, if you speak evil and judge your brother, you're speaking evil of the law. And even in today's text, he's back on the idea of the tongue. Verse 9 that Jeremy just read, do not grumble against one another, brethren. And in verse 12, but above all, my brethren, do not swear. So again and again, James has this idea that the way we speak, the words we use, reveal our Christianity. Christianity will be heard. Evil words and scandalous stories do not flow from a Holy Spirit regenerated heart. If you're a Christian, it's going to affect the way you talk. This is hard stuff. Even with the ever-presence enabling of God's power, of God's grace, it is very difficult to always choose the right words, to always speak truth and kindness. And then second, not only does James talk a lot about words that we speak, but he also talks a lot about money. You can't miss that. He started with the prejudice about rich people in the first part of chapter 2. At the end of chapter 3, he's talking about how we squabble with each other because we want to entertain ourselves. Chapter 4 says, you have desire for pleasure, and that war in your members, you lust and do not have. And of course, last week, he hammered hard in chapters 5, verses 1 through 6, on our covetous spirit. Anybody who has a focus on things in this life and stuff, boy, James hit you hard. Again and again, he talked about our attitude. How can we, surrounded by stuff and surrounded by people who are surrounded by stuff, how can you help but have your mind somewhat focused, or maybe all the time focused, about stuff? And as I thought about some of these things here in the end of the book, I'm not real happy with James. And what he's basically told me as he has gone through this, that, okay, you need to have your heart right about God, and that's going to flesh out in how you live. And then he's held up these two incredibly high standards, one being words and the other being money. And he says, if you're really a Christian, then you're going to be right in the way you speak, and you're going to be right concerning covetousness and your attitude about money. That's hard. It's like he's evaluating my very soul, my Christianity, based upon the things I say and my attitude concerning the status of my wallet. I want him to go someplace else. I want him to ask me about my Bible reading or my doctrine concerning the second coming of Christ. I'm good there. You know, I got that taken care of. Why doesn't he evaluate? But he comes to these areas where it's almost impossible for me to ever get it right. Every word that comes out of my mouth and my continuous attitude about the things in this world, stuff. Any wonder? Then James, as he comes to the end of this book, he says, therefore, my brethren, be patient. Be patient. The brethren that he refers to, of course, were the Jews that were driven from Jerusalem, those that were persecuted by both the Jewish establishment and by the Roman Empire. They were people of faith who were struggling with what was going on in life. He says, brethren, be patient. The word, the flavor of the word here that is translated patient is the idea of non-retaliation. But as Jeremy read, did you catch the theme? You can't help but catch the theme of these verses. Look at it again if you didn't catch it while he read. Therefore, be patient. And again, waits and waiting patiently. In verse 8, you also be patient. In the end of verse 10, example of suffering and patience. In verse 11, endure. And then again, the perseverance. Boy, I think 7 times in 6 verses, he uses the word patience or a similar word. Obviously, the theme here, this passage is, in light of the struggles, in light of the frustrations, and yes, even as if he's going all the way back to the beginning of the book, in light of my attitude about money and my attitude about words and my upsetness that he would be evaluating my Christianity based upon these things, therefore, be patient. Be patient until the coming of the Lord. Using the title for this book, I might say, Faith That Works Requires Patience. And truly, as a displaced pilgrim, someone who's yearning for my new Jerusalem, yearning that someday I will be delivered from this body of sin. As I think about my money and my speech, I need patience. Keeping to the pattern of the last few weeks, my thesis for today is God enables or God graces believers to be patient. And I think first he says that we need to be patient with God. I didn't first think of that idea as I read through this text. But a commentator said it, and as I thought about it more and more, I think that is what's going on in verses 7 and 8. Be patient with God, therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the latter rain. You also be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. This doctrine that Jesus is coming again, that this doctrine that Jesus is coming again is not a foolish hope. It is central to our faith. If you are a Christian, if you are orthodox in your theology, you believe that Jesus is returning. Now, Christians vary on when they think Christ will come or exactly the circumstances. But everybody who has been a Bible-believing Christian, every group has always embraced this idea that Jesus said he's coming back, he's coming again. Listen to Paul's words from Romans chapter 8. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because of the creation itself will also be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs until now. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, that is, the redemption of our body. Paul says, we live in this world and we're frustrated by the stuff of this world. There's sin. There's the absence of really knowing and seeing everything that God is. There's this veil that's in our way. And Paul says, you know, the whole creation is just like you. The grass. The earth that's rumbling under Clintonville. all these things, they're all yearning for the day when God is going to set everything right. And the day will come when God will redeem, he will buy back, he will completely deliver us from this body of sin, from this place where sin reigns and dwells. Someday we are going to be completely redeemed. Therefore, be patient. Be patient with God. Time is in his hand. That's my A there. Be patient with God because time is in God's hand. God's the one who controls this. He gives the illustration of the farmer. My wife likes listening to these Bible story tapes that she was introduced to as a child. And there's this garden story of this guy named Bobblywink. And Bobblywink and his mom planted seeds in the garden. And then a few days later, Bobblywink went out to check out the seeds, see how they were doing. Of course, he dug up the seeds, and therefore the seeds never did anything. The farmers know that's not how it works. In Israel, the early rains come in the fall, what would be our fall. The early rains come in the fall, and yes, there are rains throughout the winter period, and then there's some later rains that come in the spring. And the farmer plants his seed when the fall rains come, or he waits for the fall rains to come. He gets his seeds in the ground. They germinate, and yes, they grow through those winter rains. And then in the spring of the year, when the later rains come, it finishes filling out the crop. The crop gets to maturity, and it gets ripened because of the latter rains that come. And then before the drought, before the heat of summer, that's when you harvest the crop in Israel, if you're growing grain there. Perhaps James is thinking of the struggles of this life. And maybe that's what he says when he talks about early rains and latter rains. If you're going to have a harvest, you got to have both. You got to have the rain that will come that would mature the crop. And sometimes struggles are used to make us mature. If you want to be reminded of this, come back with me again to James chapter 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. And we talked about the fact that only a crazy man is happy when things go bad. That's nuts. But he says, knowing this, that the testing of your faith produces patience, but let patience have her perfect worth, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Maturity comes not from trouble, because if that was true, then the person who got the most trouble would be the best. No, maturity comes from our proper response, knowing this, that. And it is our response, our thinking about trouble that makes us mature. But sometimes, unless there is trouble, there's not the response that ought to be, the opportunity to learn. We don't joy in the struggle, but we joy in the maturity and in the growth that God brings us because of the trouble. We may look to God someday and say, you know, God, there's been enough rain. There's been enough trouble in my life. There's been enough frustrating things in my life. But God is the one who determines how much rain your crop needs. And God is the one who decides when the harvest is ready. You don't get to do it. We recently, here in Wisconsin, experienced the bursting of the leaves a couple weeks ago, way early. It's usually around my birthday in April that the leaves actually do something. And all, wow, they came up in the middle of March. But have you noticed what's happened the last week? Just kind of, they calmed down, didn't they? They're not bursting out. Why? It's God that decides when the harvest is ready. And in our life, truly, that's the case. Time is in God's hand. We wait for the precious fruit. We wait for the time that is God's. We also see in this passage that if we're patient with God, the reason is because time is in God's hand and our responsibility is standing firm. Standing firm is our job. He says at the end of verse 8, in my New King James, establish your hearts. The NIV says, be patient and firm. There's consistency here. Consistency is the hallmark of maturity. Nothing reveals immaturity like someone who promises or one day is hot and one day is cold and is not able to do what they've promised. And he talked about that at the beginning of this book too. Remember James 1 verse 6. He says, but let him ask in faith with no doubting. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, tossed, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. The immaturity there because he doesn't have an established heart. Isn't it amazing the way James 5 and James 1 goes together? See, he's talking about the Lord and about our thoughts of the Lord. And so he's going back and talking about the same things. He's circled around again. We've seen James's thinking doing that in his Oriental, his Hebrew mind, coming back to the same topics again. He introduced us, counseled us concerning our mind towards the Lord. And now he's coming back again and he says, in all the struggles and all the commands that we've been given, be patient. And time belongs to God. And therefore, you're going to need to be consistent. You're going to be able to stand firm. That's what you're going to need to do. I think in this, just some advice, don't try to shield your children from hard stuff. Tell your kids the truth. Tell your kids that people die, because they do. Tell your kids that people lie, because they do. Tell your kids you're broke, because sometimes we are. Tell your kids the truth. And keep on keeping on in spite of the truth, in spite of these things, because the coming of the Lord is at hand. Some have wrongly looked at this phrase here in James chapter 5 where it says the coming of the Lord is at hand and said, see, the Lord came back or the Lord was supposed to come back in the first century. These Jews knew that Jesus was coming back. It says the coming of the Lord is at hand. It's right away. Some have wrongly taught a doctrine of last things called preterism. It's the doctrine that says that Jesus fulfilled all prophecy in 70 AD and there's nothing yet to be fulfilled. I think this is a gross treatment of many biblical texts, including this one. Here, this phrase he uses that the Lord is at hand, he also uses it in Philippians chapter 4, verse 5, if you remember that. If something is at hand, it is immediately available. It's present. And truly, when compared with eternity, the return of Christ is at hand. Compared with eternity, the return of Christ is imminent, hanging over us like a large black thundercloud, waiting for rain to burst down upon us. The coming of the Lord is at hand. It's right there. And so as we think about God's harvest, as we think about God's timing, as we think about standing firm and being there on the line, fighting as we are supposed to, God's coming. His picture, his timing is imminent. And we may say, well, you know, it's been 2,000 years and now it's been all my life. I've often repeated that when I was a kid, my grandpa was preaching in chart evangelism and he was preaching on eschatology. He was preaching on last things. And grandpa's chart showed that the coming of the Lord would have to be by 2000. I mean, that was a date that he had written on the chart. Because after all, we believed that there were 6,000 years of human history according to his cool little chart. And so the Lord would have to come back by then. And he talked about the fact that the fig tree had bloomed Israel in 1948 and a generation was 40 years. I remember as a teenager living in the 60s and 70s, Grandpa saying, Jesus will come back by 1988 because that's when the generation of the fig tree blooming will be in existence, will be done. Well, Grandpa's in heaven. And Jesus didn't come back Was Grandpa wrong? He wasn't wrong. He was wrong about the fig tree thing, obviously. But he wasn't wrong about the imminency, though. And he wasn't wrong to preach and teach that the coming of the Lord was at hand. It wasn't wrong for James to write that 2,000 years ago. And surely it's not wrong for us to say it today. Because in light of eternity, in light of the length of time we are going to be forever with Christ, it is imminent, it is momentary, there's nothing stopping it from happening. That's one of the truths that's true, or that is taught by that idea that the coming of the Lord is at hand. I see that God enables or graces believers to be patient with God, be patient with people. I think that's what's going on in verse 9 when he talks about grumbling. Do not grumble. I love that word. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. We grumble against each other, and in the context here, this is the obvious conclusion. We grumble against each other because we are impatient with each other. Do you know why I'm impatient with people? Do you know why I don't like people? People are inconvenient. They really are. People are always taking the things that I want to have, and they're always in the way of me doing what I want to do. People are very inconvenient, and people are very inconsiderate. They are self-centered. They have what I want, and they don't care that I want what they have. I hope you hear my immaturity. Immaturity and patience are partners. Maturity, rather. Maturity and patience are partners, and immaturity and impatience, they are also fellow gang members. We should be patient with people. People are going to irritate you. People are going to do things that you don't want them to do. Just count on it. And in this life, as we sin against each other, it's inevitable that people will irritate you. Be patient. Don't grumble. And our motivation to be patient with people, we're being watched. Nothing makes little children in school allow others to go first like the knowledge that the principal is watching. Nothing makes little children in a home share their toys like the knowledge that dad is looking in the door of the room. And so the judge is standing at the door. He says, Christ is watching. Be patient with each other. Don't grumble against each other when you find people are immature and inconsiderate and impatient with you. No. Don't grumble against them, but rather be patient with them because you're being watched. The imminency, again, is that he's at the door. He could walk in at any moment. Therefore, don't grumble. Be patient with people. And then I think he says in verses 10 and 11, be patient with the struggles of life. Be patient with life. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed to endure. Patience strengthens our relationship with people and God. That's what I think he's saying in verses 10 and 11a. James says, I want you to think about the prophets. Okay, let's think about the prophets. There was Elijah. Yeah, you know, I don't think I want to be like Elijah. He got fed by a vulture. And he got chased by Jezebel. She threatened to kill him, the queen did. He ended up living in a foreign country for a while. And then when he did have his grand display on Mount Carmel, that wasn't good either, because then Jezebel really wanted to kill him. He ended up running for his life and dying in a state of depression. Now, I don't want to be like Elijah. Okay, think about the prophets. What about Daniel? Daniel in the lion's den? I don't want to do that. How about Isaiah? Yeah, well, read his book and then remember that tradition says he was sawn in half. Jeremiah, that's a great prophet, big book in the Bible. But Jeremiah, we call him the weeping prophet. He was thrown by his own countrymen into a miry pit. And yet he says here in verse 11, we count them blessed. See the irony? We like the prophets, but we don't want their trouble. And we don't like our troubles, and yet we say, oh, to be like Daniel. Oh, to see God work the way Elijah did. Oh, if only I was as passionate and determined as Jeremiah. And really, what these guys had in common were their suffering credentials. That's the only thing these prophets had in common, was that life was difficult and hard, and everybody hated them. And yet, because they endured, he says, we call them blessed. We look at them and go, oh, What wonderful people they were. You know what made them wonderful people? You know what made us think of them as wonderful people? The fact that they endured. The fact that when troubles came, they just kept on keeping on. They were patient with life. I want to give an illustration from the real life of one of our school families. There's a family in our school, Jim and Renee Eckberg. They have a special needs boy. Everybody knows Joey or has seen Joey here for different things. They bring him to the games. None of us would ask God to give us or wish upon our children or as a grandchild a boy with the special needs that Joey has. I wouldn't pray for that for myself or anybody else. And yet, may I make two observations in this idea of enduring and patience as I think about the Eckberg family. One, every member of the Eckberg family is different because of Joey. And may I propose to you that I think every single one of them is better because of Joey. You watch their compassion. You watch the way they work with each other. They adjust their life. You watch the things that they've put up with because of their passion for and their love for Joey. And I look at them and I say, every single one of that family has grown as a person and is better because of Joey. Again, I don't wish Joey's condition upon anybody or any family. And yet, my estimation of my respect for the Eckbergs is greater because of Joey. And I think that not only are they a different person, but I've already gotten in my other one. Everyone who knows the Eckbergs thinks more highly of them. Not only are they a different person, but we think more highly of them. Endurance impresses people. When people endure, when people go through something hard, you know, we congratulate people who lose weight or people who work out because we know the endurance, the work that is involved. I was driving down Highway 23, the ledge, the other day, and as I was driving down the ledge, there was running up two teenage boys. Looked like they were maybe 16 to 20, somewhere in that neighborhood. And they were dressed in track-type stuff, probably maybe some athlete with one of the local schools. And they were running up the ledge. They were running quickly up the ledge. And I was sitting my fat body in my car going down the ledge, and I was in awe. I know how long I would run up the ledge, maybe four steps, and then I would start slowing down. It wouldn't be long, but here they were. They were running hard up the ledge. I was impressed. I was impressed. So if you want better relations with people and God, then patiently endure life's struggles. Nobody... I'm going to use a crude term from our family. Nobody likes a whiny butt. You know? Nobody likes somebody that's always griping and always complaining. But the person who endures, their relationship, like that of the prophets to God and of the prophets to other people, it's impressive. We appreciate them. We love them. They're better people because they've endured the trouble, because they've gone through the fire, because they've kept on going. They didn't quit. Be patient with the struggles of life. Patience strengthens our relationship with people and God. And patience also allows us to see God's character. I think it's going on at the end of verse 11 where he says this. You've heard of the perseverance of Job. And seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. Job was known as the greatest man in the region before his troubles. But after his troubles, God met with Job and called him my servant Job. And we have continued talking about this man in glowing term for 4,000 years. Because Job persevered, because he endured, Job knew the mercy and compassion of God. Let me go on, verse 12. But above all my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment. Now, what in the world is this doing with patience? Why is this passage, this verse here? And some commentators say, well, this obviously has nothing to do with the stuff before. The two different men that I read said that this verse can't have anything to do with what's going on here. He must have switched subjects. And then in verse 13, he switches subjects again. This is a standalone verse. Well, if that's true, then why does he begin it in my New King James with the word but? There's a conjunction here. Sometimes we Fondalakians add multitudinous, unnecessary conjunctions to our speech, but God does not. When God puts the word but in here, it's for a reason. So he must still be talking about struggles and being patient in our struggles. I think he's still talking about this, and so I'm going to write here, be patient with the truth. Be patient with the truth. Be patient with reality. Anyone who's ever struggled or suffered deeply knows the frustration of embracing reality. They say that the first stage of grief is denial. Sometimes we continue to live in denial. We may want to make deals with God, or we may say things we don't really mean to say when troubles come, like Peter did when he cursed and swore in the courtyard. It was a difficult situation he found himself in, and so he responded verbally in a way he should not have. And we wonder what terrible things we might have done, or what terrible things God must think about us to deserve this. And I think what's going on here in 5:12 is akin to when he's talking about presumptuousness at the end of verse 13, end of chapter 4, verses 13 and on, when he says, come now, you who say tomorrow or today, we're going to go do this. And he says in verse 14, he rebukes him, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. And I think that's the same sin that he's talking about here in verse 12, or the same attitude where he says, you think you can, life is what it is, and you look at life and you go, you know what, it's going to be better. I'm going to do this. And the truth of the matter is, you're counting on something that you have no control. You don't know what's going to happen. Karl Marx said, religion is the opium of the people. He believed that the objects of our Christian faith was merely fairy tales and foolishness. The truth is just the opposite. Christians embrace our wicked depravity. Christians embrace the wrongness of this world. Christians understand that this world is cursed and damned and without hope. Christians understand that no one gets out of this life alive. We all die. But Christians also embrace eternity. And that's where Karl Marx and every atheist, anyone who denies God, they cannot embrace the reality of eternity, that God is. I believe what's going on in verse 12 is when he talks about swearing, he's talking about slandering a greater. Yes, misusing God's name would go in here, but it's also the idea of vowing or promising what is beyond your control, something that you cannot control. It is presumptuously, and therefore it is stealing from God, taking away from God. I'm going to do this wonderful thing. You don't know that you can do that. I note Job's response as Job was confronted with the things that happened to him in Job chapter 1. Job said this, naked I came from my mother's womb and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Job did not blame. Job did not try to pretend that what was not. Job did not vow that he was going to recover, that he was going to overcome, that he was going to get everything that he had lost. No. And note the emphasis of the passage here in James 5:12. He says, but above all, of all the things he says, of all the things he says about suffering and patience and the coming of the Lord here, he says, don't do this. Why? Because God hates lying. Don't let your dreams cause you to say what is not. Don't make promises that cannot be true. I remember once as a kid, listening to a conversation in my home between my mom and dad, and they were talking about a young lady that they had recently encountered. And this young lady had been promised by another preacher that he would pay for her college education, that she would get to go to Bible college, and that he would make sure that it happened, that he would foot the bill. And I remember my parents, in typical parsonage sarcasm, commenting that it would be nice if that preacher would pay the bills he already had before he promised to pay for somebody else's girl to go to school. We can tell the truth. We can embrace the truth. We can repeat the truth because God is faithful and true. Be patient with the truth. We read this morning of the Palm Sunday triumphant entry of Jesus Christ. On that day, God fulfilled many prophecies. Some as generic as God's first prophecy to Eve that a descendant of hers would come and crush Satan's heel. Some as specific as Zechariah's prophecy concerning the donkey Jesus rode, or Daniel's prophecy concerning the exact day the king would enter. Regardless, Jesus fulfilled every prophecy, no matter how generic or specific, on that day. Is it delusional for Christians to believe that there is hope? As you examine life and our frustrations with perfection and our sufferings and our endurances, we examine these things, all the things that James has talked about in this book that he expects us to do, and yet life is not right. It is not right. It's all messed up. Is it delusional to believe that Jesus is coming again? No. No, it's a reality. It's a fact. Just as he came the first time, so he's coming again. So what should our attitude be about today? The problems of life. Where is God today? Where is God today in my heart? And where is God today in my physical needs and my emotional needs? Where is God today in making me the Christian I ought? Why aren't things right today? So he writes, therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. That's what our attitude should be like today in all these things. Be patient. If today I chased too many rabbits and I said too many things, take this away. Life is frustrating. And I am most frustrated most often with myself. And as he's talked about money and speech, surely I am guilty. So what's my attitude? What should my attitude be? Be patient. Even with me. Dan, be patient with yourself. Be patient. For the coming of the Lord is at hand. Father, thank you for your promises and thank you for your word. And thank you that in the struggles of life, there's rewards for those who endure. There's rewards for those that just keep on believing and keep on hanging on to God. Keep on knowing that regardless of what happens in this life, that God is and that God will finish the task. Oh, for a heart that would know you completely. Paul yearned for a day when the veil would go away. So, Jesus, we yearn for a better day. And until then, God, give us grace. Or should we say, we claim your grace and your ability to be patient with you, with truth, with the facts of life, with each other. So God, thank you for patience. In Jesus' name, amen.